The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good evening, everyone. Now, welcome to IMC. And it might be a little bit loud today, the volume. So let's see, how does that sound? Does that sound loud enough for everyone? Yep? Okay. So, I think there's a fair number of people who, one way or the other, are concerned about knowing what is the right thing to do. Maybe because they want to do the right thing, or they want to somehow at least know what it is. There are people who want to know what the ethical thing is to do. What's the right thing to do, the wrong thing to do, the good thing to do, the bad thing to do. And when people come to religions such as Buddhism, that sometimes takes a stronger emphasis because somehow religion is supposed to have wisdom, rules, ideas about what is right, what is good, what is ethical. And it's not a few people who will come to a Buddhist teacher and ask, you know, what is the right thing to do here? And in some ways it's quite a wonderful thing that people are concerned and careful, and many people ask the question because they don't want to harm someone. But sometimes the question's asked because they have some abstract idea that there's a right and a wrong, a good and a bad, and they want to at least, you know, somehow they have this idea, they're obligated, they're required to do the right thing or be the right thing. And if they're Buddhist, they want to know the Buddhist right thing. And if they're Buddhist at a Buddhist center, then they're particularly concerned about doing the right thing. So I'm going on like this because it's a one way of thinking. It's not so uncommon. But what would happen if instead of asking what is the right thing, what is the good thing to do, what's the ethical thing to do, what if the question was, what's the beautiful thing to do? What's the beautiful thing to do here? I think that that would create a different kind of orientation. I believe that the question, what's the beautiful thing, would be... would not immediately evoke people's ethical sensibilities or immediately evoke the idea of what's the right thing to do and see if we have an obligation or duty to do the right thing or all that. I think if you ask what's the beautiful thing to do, I think some people would relax or be inspired or, oh, that's an interesting thing. Yeah, I'd like to know what that is. And there'd be a little bit more inspiration or maybe even delight. What's the beautiful thing to do? And this is also true, you know, for in our own minds. You know, it's one thing to do the right thing in terms of our behavior in the world and what we say. It's another thing to be concerned about what's the right thing for your own mind. And that can be particularly oppressive and burden for people because, you know, we're not exactly in control of our own mind. Our mind has a mind of its own sometimes, and it has its own thoughts and impulses and desires and all kinds of things goes on in there. But to have this idea that certain movements of the mind are the wrong movements to have, the bad movements to have, and movements of the mind are sometimes, some people identify them much more closely to who they really are, than maybe their actions. And so not a few people struggle with themselves, are in conflict with themselves because have some idea that they're supposed to kind of internally be a certain way. They're supposed to always be generous or always have good thoughts and always have compassionate thoughts or, you know, or not be the opposite of those things. All kinds of ideas. But what if you ask your mind, you look at your mind and wonder about how the mind operates, and there too you ask the question, what's the beautiful thing for my mind to do? How would that shift you? What's the beautiful thing here? What would be the beautiful thing if it's internally in your own mind and no one else sees it? Why bother? It's beautiful. It's a delight. It's a joy. It's an inspiration. It's just like, of course, you know, it would be nice to have it beautiful in there. What if your mind was one of the most beautiful things that you've ever seen in the world? Well, how would you relate to your mind if you decided the mind was really beautiful? There's a story I'd like to tell of... I went at some point to... when I was about 30, I'd been practicing for about 10 years or so, and I went to Asia to practice. I went to... and part of to doing Vipassana... I did a month-long retreat in Kathmandu, in Nepal. So I arrived there some days before the retreat, and you know, I didn't have anything to do. I just wandered around. Was a little bit of a tourist, and just wandered around the streets and here and there. They had all these little shops with Buddhist artwork and paintings and statues and things and clothes and stuff mostly for the tourists coming through. And there was one shop that had a Buddhist statue in the window that really captivated me. I think I'd like to buy that. So I had very little money. I don't remember how much I had, but I don't even remember how much a statue cost, but you know, it was a lot of money. It was probably like $100. And that was maybe a third of how much money I had. You know, third of my worldly wealth. So it was a lot of money, right? And I was in Asia. You know, to try to be there to practice for the duration. I had no plans of coming back exactly. I was just there to practice. So it was a little bit big deal to buy it or not buy it. But you know, it was really a good statue. And then it occurred to me that as beautiful and inspiring as the statue was, the most beautiful thing I know in the universe is a pure mind. And then I thought to myself, I'm going to not buy it and save my wealth and use it to support someone else to do this practice so they can experience that mind. So that was a decision. And then I don't know if it was just hours later or a day later or something like that, I called back to Berkeley. I went to the post office where you had to make long-distance calls and called back to Berkeley to talk to my girlfriend. And her roommate answered. I said, could I talk to her? And he said, oh, she's on her way to Kathmandu to see you. And she had less money than me. That's where that $100 went. Because she was coming to practice too. So, beautiful mind. The teacher that I practiced with there, named Upandita, he has a book titled The Mind Called Beautiful. The idea that the mind can be beautiful. So how beautiful is your mind? And what would it take to make your mind beautiful? So this is not just an abstract idea, you know, just a nice gillism here. But it turns out that in the ancient teachings of the Buddha, he uses the word beauty and beautiful quite frequently. But it's not obvious in the English translations. Many of the translations translate this word, kalyana, as good. And one of the places it appears has to do with karma. And translators will translate good karma and bad karma as good karma and bad karma. But the word for good is not good. The word is kalyana. And it's a hugely different thing if you talk about, say, in Buddhism, the concern about karma. Karma means your actions that have consequences. And you want to be careful with your actions, your karma. And the concern is not about doing good and avoiding bad. The concern is to avoid, is to do beautiful karma, beautiful actions. And then, literally, and there's a passage where it says you do beautiful actions for beautiful results. Isn't that kind of nice? It's a whole different, it kind of takes the ethical sting out of this whole karma idea, if the idea is to be, you know, to do the beautiful thing. You see one of the places where this emphasis on beauty gets really strong emphasis in Buddhism is there's a common expression that the Buddha said, and others quote him, that the Dharma, which is the teachings, the practice, the path that we're involved in Buddhism, is the common translation is that Dharma is good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good at the end. So it's a good. It's good that it's good. But the word good, you know, it's okay. It's so good. It's good. You know, oatmeal is good. It's good for you. You know, so I'm happy that it's good. But it turns out that it's this word kalyana, which the first dictionary definition in many of the dictionaries, Indian English dictionaries, is beautiful. The Dharma is beautiful in the beginning, beautiful in the middle, beautiful at the end. Wow. I mean, now we're talking, I mean, that's like, wow. You know, good doesn't really get me going. But beautiful, wow. The Dharma is beautiful. Now, how does that work? Where do I find that beauty? Well, guess where? You find it in yourself. What's the beautiful thing to do? What's the beautiful thing to do as you go about your daily life? What if what you do is supposed to? What if you do your actions? What you do in the world is beautiful. How about if you drive beautifully? I wonder what that would look like if everyone was driving beautifully. I don't know. I'm not sure what it would look like, but I sure know what it doesn't look like. We see a lot of it, and sometimes the standard people have of what's beautiful, you know, is things that are performed really well. And sometimes looking at dance or athleticism, people who have mastered and developed themselves and trained themselves, and they do something with elegance and simplicity and care and mastery, and it can just be beautiful to watch. Wow, look at that. I don't know if any of you have done a Japanese tea ceremony, but to watch someone who's really trained, to the way they pour the tea and hold the cups, and it's kind of just, you know, beautiful to watch. It's kind of first, it can be mesmerizing, the beauty of it. Wow, that's so elegant and beautiful. I once watched at the Green Gulch Zen Center, and they had this very big, somewhat oldish barn that became their meditation hall. And the floor is just kind of this wooden old floor. And it's kind of a beautiful place. And they had Mrs. Nakamura Sensei, a woman who was a tea teacher there, taught Japanese tea ceremony for a few decades at Zen Center. And she was, I think, going back to Japan after living at Zen Center and teaching tea for decades. And they were going to have a kind of final ceremony to honor her. And she was going to make tea in the meditation hall. And because of my role there, I was placed kind of at the center. She was the center of it, but kind of like 3 feet away from her. I was sitting like I am now, and she was sitting just a few feet away. And I got to watch her make tea. She was in her 80s, and that was beautiful. Just the way she used her wrists and her hands and picked things up. And the fact that you can pick up a bowl, a tea bowl, and just watching a person pick it up, was wow, this is art, wow. So what's the beautiful way to hand your friend a cup of tea? What's the beautiful way to offer a gift? Gifts are nice to give. And so in Buddhism, and it's also like in places like Japan, the beautiful way is to do it with both hands. So you kind of put yourself together and you're really there fully for the experience. It's like you're really, really there and doing it consciously, intentionally, as opposed to handing that, you know, and looking the other way. Here, this is for you, throwing at them. You know, it's a very different thing. Generosity is beautiful. What about being generosity for the kind of for the sake of beauty or as an act of beauty as opposed to a duty? It's a very different feeling, very different thing. So so karma is sometimes categorized as being beautiful. And it's not actually, the word is not bad. Not bad. I like to translate the word that's used as malicious. So you want to avoid doing the things that are malicious and do the things which are beautiful. And this word for karma, comes from it means action. There's a lot of related words in Buddhism. And one of the related, etymologically related words is the word sankhara. The sun means with, and the kara means to make, to do, kind of. It has to do, sankharas are the inner mental actions that we do, the activity of the mind. In particular, the activities of the mind that influence us, influence how the mind works and shapes the mind. So if you're constantly thinking miserly thoughts, you know, and do it regularly, that's going to influence the habits of the mind. If you are regularly being generous, that's going to influence you in a different way. One of them might keep you contracted and tight, fearful and kind of separated from people. The second, being generous, might make you feel more open and generous and more happy to see people. And if you do that once or twice, you probably haven't created much influence on you. But if you spend years one way or the other, it creates a big change in who we are. One of them creates beauty. One of them creates something like the opposite of it. So the mental activity that we do, sankharas, are consequential. And so we can ask ourselves, what is a beautiful thing to do in the mind? Well, Buddhism has an answer. Because these mental activities that we have in the mind, some of them, are divided up, categorized in all kinds of ways. But there's two major categories. There's the category of those things which are unskillful to do or unwholesome to do. And in street language, those are the bad ones. But, you know, that it's unskillful, that's a very different feeling than saying it's bad. It's just not skillful, not useful, it's not helpful. So there's those. And then the opposite ones, you would think that they are the skillful ones, the wholesome ones. But what they are, what they're called, the beautiful ones. They are the beautiful states of mind. It's a different word, it's soba now, rather than kalyana. But the beautiful states of mind. And, because of this, the way psychological analysis works, it's not that comprehensive of all the things that we might think of as being, you know, beautiful states, qualities of mind. But it is an interesting list. I don't remember all of them at the moment, but there are things like faith or trust, confidence is considered beautiful. Mindfulness is considered a beautiful state. And that's a little bit hard for some of us to tell when we're new to practice or struggling in the practice, and mindfulness is hard to come by. But when mindfulness is strong and stable and we're steadied in this very clear, strong, present moment awareness, the mindfulness is not just a good idea. Mindfulness becomes a state of clear awareness that, when it's established, would be similar to the there being no smog or haze in the Bay Area air. And for those of you who live here in the peninsula, and when the air is clear, it's really nice to look across the bay, and surprising how close the East Bay Hills are. But on many days, you can't see across the bays. And so when it's clear, it's really clear. Wow, that's cool. So when mindfulness is strong, the state of the mind, the state of the clarity of the mind, the knowing quality of mind, is kind of like that. Wow, I know it's clear. It has a certain elegance and beauty. And then there's things like the lightness of the mind, buoyancy of the mind. Isn't that kind of nice? Uprightness of the mind, kind of rectitude of the mind. A conscience, having a conscience is considered a beautiful thing. And softness of the mind, tranquility of the mind. And that's probably all I can remember at the moment. But if these things are well established, they're nice. Like a tranquil mind, you can understand how it can be beautiful when you compare it to the opposite, which is an agitated mind. And many people come to meditation in order to quiet and to calm an agitated mind. And when it is, it can be kind of really, really exquisite. I talked about this beautiful mind that we can experience sometimes. One of the higher quality minds that we can experience is, in fact, a mind that's very, very tranquil. Not tranquil and numb, not tranquil and kind of, unenergized, but tranquil and clear. It's like a profound state of peace that you feel, you sense, you experience, you see kind of in the mind. Another thing on the list that I just remember now is equanimity, or a sense of a balanced mind. The mind that's equanimous and balanced. So it's not, out of balance. People get off balance, they say. But they really feel strongly balanced. These things feel. They're not ideas. These are states of mind that really feel, or they're palpable and good. So, what's the beautiful thing to do in the mind? And this word sankhara, which, has to be related to this action, if you look it up in the various dictionaries, especially Sanskrit dictionaries, for its meanings, it has a wide range of meanings that probably, because, it's the Indian language that Buddhism is using, it probably related to this word sankhara. Unfortunately, the English translations lose some of the richness of the word. The most common English translation lately is mental formations. You have mental formations. I'm sure this was a good news for you. My better effort at a translation these days, which is not any better or less, maybe less inspiring than formations, is constructs or constructions. And someone else does fabrications. Thanks. Fabrications. So all these, they don't really do justice. But if you look up in the Sanskrit English dictionary, you find that it meanings like to put together, to make, to prepare, to consecrate, to make sacred, to polish a gem, to refine a metal, to perform sacred rituals. It's actually the, it's almost like the word sankara, samskara in Sanskrit, can is almost like equivalent or used as the equivalent to our word ritual, religious rituals. For Brahmins, there are 12 rites of passage over a lifetime. They're called 12 samskaras. You get a very different feeling when you get this association with making sacred and consecrating and polishing and making, you know, it's kind of like making beautiful, you know, making special. And so to translate things as, you know, constructs and fabrications and things, you kind of lose some of those rich associations. I don't think we can translate it as to make it beautiful, but I think that loses some of the meanings of it. But the associations are like that. So what if meditation is a practice of beautifying your mind? The Buddha talked about that. He talked about adorning the mind. So adorning your mind. Maybe that's not very interesting. A lot of people are motivated to come to meditation because they suffer. And they're stressed, they're agitated, they're having problems, and they want something to get some relief, some kind of help to get free of that. And they heard that Buddhist meditation is to bring an end to suffering. It's pretty promising. Some people, if they hear, oh, you know, come to Buddhism and have a beautiful mind, they might think, well, that's self-indulgent. You know, there's important things to do in the world, there are important websites to visit. And to indulge in just making a beautiful mind, I mean, that doesn't seem very good. And then I remember when I was, I haven't heard this now for many, many years, but when I was a new Buddhist practitioner in my early 20s, I heard this a lot. Maybe society's changed now, but back then, you tell people that you meditated, people who don't meditate, and they would say, oh, that's selfish. And I said, what? You know, I meditate an hour. That's selfish? Yeah, because it's self-involved. You know, you're focusing on yourself and self-involved, and you should go do things for people. And I think that the idea that meditation is selfish maybe came because Buddhism was considered a religion, and religion is supposed to be altruistic. Since you weren't being altruistic, you were being selfish. The same people who would say that's selfish to meditate for an hour, they would spend 3-4 hours on television, watching television. But it didn't occur to them that that was selfish. So it was kind of like cognitive dissonance for me that people would say, you know, watch television for 4 hours and then tell me that for my 1 hour meditation was selfish. But I think if you tell that the purpose of Buddhist meditation is to make a beautiful mind, maybe it doesn't really inspire people, or maybe that seems selfish or indulging. But what if, in fact, Buddhist meditation is to do a very profound thing, is to really help you get to the bottom, to the root of your suffering, and show you liberation, show you a freedom from it, a profound state of peace that gives birth to wonderful qualities of mind. And often Buddhist teachers say, well, it gives birth to compassion, because that has cachet. You know, that's like the people who want us to be helpful in the world, they really value that. So that seems like a good fruit of practice. And it is. But what if we say that, yes, we're here to do a path of practice that leads to freedom from suffering. And the means to that is to cultivate a beautiful mind. The means to freedom from suffering is cultivate a beautiful mind. When you think things, what would be that beautiful thing to think? When you engage in meditation practice and make an effort to be mindful, not what's the right way to make effort, what's the beautiful way to make effort? The quality of the way you pay attention. Is there a way of doing that beautifully? Like you're doing a Japanese tea ceremony in your mind. What is it to bring your attention carefully, look at the experience you have, attend to what's happening with your breathing, with your body, in such a way that it's, you know, it's elegant, it's inspiring. You know, if someone looked at you from the outside, they'd be inspired by it. What's the beautiful thing to do? How do you practice beautifully? Would that free you from striving, free you from being upset with yourself if your mind wanders off in thought a lot? Because that wouldn't be beautiful. You know, Gil, you just blew it. You slipped off your breath. You missed 10 breaths. You know, that was really a drag. You know, that's not inspiring. But rather, Gil, you just wandered off. Here, come back. I'll help you. Come back to your breathing and settle there. Why not that way? Have you listened to the tone of your voice? So those of you who think in words, you know, in inner conversations, that some people, when they start paying attention to the tone of their inner voice, find that it's harsh or angry. What if who's in control of the tone of your voice in there? Do you just have to go along with what's given to you? Or can you, in some ways, take some responsibility for how you think and think about yourself? Can you do it in ways that are inspiring? Do it in ways that are conducive to certainly peace and well-being, but also a sense of beauty? The Buddha said that beautiful actions lead to beautiful results. Beautiful ways of relating to ourselves, beautiful ways of thinking and talking lead to beautiful results. So, I think I've probably done my job that I intended here today. I don't know if it was beautifully done. But I did want to try to emphasize a particular point, particular idea that's missing, for the most part, in English discussions of Buddhism, that creates a very different perspective, orientation, or approach to how we would live our lives or how we would engage in meditation practice or Buddhist practice, that brings in a reference point for it that could make things a lot easier, can make things kind of, creates a very different kind of, I think, a much more compassionate or caring or careful way of how to do this that is freed of things which are the opposite. Freed from being angry with yourself, self-deprecating, from a sense of harsh duty, feelings that, you know, that you have to walk on eggshells to be a good Buddhist because you have to do the right thing and avoid the bad thing. There's all kinds of ways in which people engage in maybe any religion, which actually, is, at least in terms of Buddhism, many ways people engage in Buddhism that's rather un-Buddhist. And what I mean by that is that hopefully, if the purpose of Buddhist practice is to become free of suffering, don't suffer because of Buddhism. You know, that doesn't make sense, right? So, I have to do this Buddhist thing, I have to follow the Buddhist way of life, I'm not doing it right, I'm supposed to be mindful, that's what Buddhism teaches, I have to be mindful so that I can be free of suffering, and I'm not doing it right, I'm terrible. You know, it's illogical. So to find a way to do this Buddhist practice that we live a good life, we support people in our lives, and we take care of ourselves, maybe sometimes we need different language, different concepts in which to kind of look at this and understand it. And so I've offered you this word today. And maybe you'll find it interesting to experiment with it, explore it, and to ask yourself the question, what's the beautiful thing to do in your actions, in your speech, and in your mind? And maybe keeping that, you might even, you know, try it for a week. Just keep that question close by. Maybe even write it on your palm of your hand or someplace, you know, carry it with you. And then keep asking yourself that question and see what kind of answers you come up with. And will those answers be different than the kind of answers that lead you to live a different life than what you've been doing so far? So that's my thoughts. So we have 10 minutes before the end. And if any of you would like to ask a question or comment or protest, beautifully, yes. If you can wait for the mic, please.
Okay. And turn it on. There's a button.
Check.
It's going to be
green. Check. Okay. Well, I mean, as long as we're dealing with meanings of words, I mean, beautiful has a lot of different meanings too.
Sure.
And so is it up to each person to decide what they mean by beautiful, or, you know, are there
there's a right
guidelines?
Way of being beautiful.
Okay.
Let me get out the Buddhist texts.
Okay.
So I tell you what the right way is. No, I think it's personal. But I'm very interested in your question about the idea that has many connotations or association. Do you want to say a little bit more how different people might understand it, or different interpretations people have of that?
Well, you know, there's the most, you know, obvious interpretation of, like, surface beauty, you know, do you look good doing something,
uh-huh.
You know? There's, you know, sort of beautiful in the kind of overall implications, you know, something is beautiful if it brings about good results, and not beautiful, it doesn't bring about bad results. And then there's the whole association of beauty with skillfulness, too. I mean, things that, as you were saying with the Japanese tea ceremony, things that are skillfully done are also beautiful. So, I mean, those are just, you know, off the top of my head. So.
Yeah, good, great. And what do you think, which of those do you think Buddhism points towards?
I think the skillful connotation.
Skillful
connotations.
Great. Thank you.
Although, you know, it's interesting because, you know, the Chinese, who are the predecessors to the Japanese, they don't care about that tea ceremony stuff at all.
They make beautiful Buddhist temples. This is straight back.
I was doing this kind of linguistic tripping on the words right and ethical, and the way that they sounded in my head, and right. And ethical. They have a hard kind of straight edge to them.
Uh-huh.
And also it's very easy to slip off into a judgmental aspect,
uh-huh,
of what is right and ethical. But the word beautiful had much more softness and roundness to it, and an expansiveness to it. And I was just kind of tripping on that.
Great, wonderful. Is there another mic here? Because it can go straight there. It's back there. Okay.
Let's see, how do I put this? A friend of mine is an avid Buddhist practitioner, and when I was asking him, how do you decide, you know, what's the most skillful, how do you, he was always very, very confident in his actions, and I was like, how do you do that? Because I would see his actions and go, like, there was, like, 10 things wrong with what you just did, and I do that to myself, and he would say, I'm secure in my own good intentions, and it would drive me crazy, because kind of like the definition of, you know, beautiful is different to everyone, I would look at my own actions and think, I can see at least 10 ways in which I'm doing something wrong, and if I really, really try hard, I can see one way that I'm doing them right. And so I guess I'm curious how to ask this question. if beautiful action is subjective, and we sort of to me, I would define my action as beautiful if I knew that it came from a really good intention. But when I see 10 different intentions going on at the same time, do I just get to pick one? and go, all right, I see the compassion in this part of Emily's thinking. So
flip a coin.
Yeah.
It's a great question. One of the criteria that is very important in Buddhism is not to cause harm. But even that is hard to know whether what causes harm or not. But we do our best. I was very lucky, I felt, when I was 17, I was talking to an adult, an aunt, and she said, I was asking that kind of question, and she pointed out that we have a range of intentions, and so if 70% is a good intention, but 30 is not, don't sacrifice the 70 good intention for the 30, bad intention. Meaning we have multiple intentions, but you have to weigh them together and not rule out something just because, to doing something because some of the intentions are maybe a little bit off. So for example, you might want to help your neighbors because, the neighbor is sick. But one intention is, you want everyone in the street to know that you're the best helper on the block. That kind of egotism is probably not so useful. But she still needs help, your neighbor. So just put up with your egotism so you can help her, because it's a better intention. So to weigh and look at the balance of things and see what percentage they are, which is the higher percentage, and look at what the consequences can be. And if all things are equal, then also look at the consequences for yourself. Which makes you a better person? Which helps you grow and develop and become a more freer person, a kinder person, a happier person? So that's my answer. Is that adequate?
It's wonderful. To clarify a little bit, is it like if I have one selfish intention and one selfless intention, that I can kind of take a minute and try and dwell with this, with the beautiful, let's say, with the beautiful intention and kind of align myself, and if the other one's still kind of there and like it's getting its way, that's okay, but I'm going to align with the other one.
Yeah, to give up the good intention just because a little bit of bad intention is kind of being held hostage, or kind of like, it's better just to ignore it, the bad one. It comes along. But it's a matter of balance, right, and the harm caused. So if it's 99% bad and 1% good, well, then maybe you want to kind of, take a second look.
Beautiful.
I saw one more hand, and then maybe we can, if you don't mind, bring the mic all the way.
Over here?
Yeah, I saw it over there first, so, and then...
Sorry.
No, not you? I thought I saw a hand. Okay, maybe this man here, gentleman here.
Hi. So, in earlier life, like more than 20 years ago, I had the chance to live in Asia, and I got to go to Japan many times, and I saw the tea ceremony put on by a master who took 20 years of her life to get to that level. I still remember it to this day, and I do remember how she served the tea, rotating the cup around, delivering it to the individual. And that wasn't the only beautiful ceremony I remember seeing, even though I hadn't practiced. I mean, I've only been practicing for about 5 years. But the exchange of business cards, I thought, was also quite a beautiful ceremony, with the two-hand delivery and the two-hand reception and the studying of the card and the acknowledgement. I just thought that it was, there must be a lot of beautiful things happening out there that if you take a step back to see them, they're happening all over. So,
and so some of the things that are being expressed also in that kind of care is also... respect. There's a kind of a respect for the other person, a valuing other person when you give something really consciously and carefully and fully, as opposed to just kind of, throw the business card at them. And
Or the tea.
Yeah. Great. So thank you. And if this was somehow a provocatively useful, interesting idea that I presented today. If some of you would like to tell me in some months what kind of difference it made in your life, I'd be very happy to hear. Thank you.